Hi everybody, I'm Jonas and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Jonas.
You all are going to have the pleasure to hear my friend Terry tell his story. He's one of the first people that I met when I moved here to Atlanta. And he's just one of those guys that is always there welcoming. You know, do you know the one in the meeting? Hi, how are you? And always comes up to you and says hi to you and looks you in the eye and is genuinely going, how are you? And you can tell they mean it. It's not like, oh, hi, how are you? You know, it's one of those. And that's always a great example to me. And I haven't heard his story, but I've heard him share, and I see what he does all the time. And he's a great AA member, and you all are in for a real treat. So with that, I give you Terry.
Thank you. My name's Terry. I am an alcoholic. Matter of fact, I used to hear 14 years ago when I got sober and I came in the rooms, they go, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. And I used to hear that and go, you gotta be an idiot. I didn't understand it. And what I didn't understand is having gone through the program, having done the steps in the book and having come out to the other side, there's a strange side effect to this disease of alcoholism. You actually become a better person than where you were before going into it. And I can't think of any other disease that's like that. If you have, like, lung cancer and you take the radiation therapy and stuff like that, the best you can get is where you started before you had the cancer. It's not like you could now breathe underwater as a side effect. Anyway, when Jonas, I immediately took a liking to him. He was in my home group in Chicago 14 years ago. So that was like an instant connection over there. And it was a very enthusiastic group, and I really care for him deeply. My drinking, I heard a speaker share this year, and I liked it because I could encompass my drinking in the little story. It goes, I don't know the guy's name, but if you bring in a big wagon of booze, of every kind of booze in the world, right in this room, and said, okay, everybody have six strong ones as much as you want. And so everybody gets six, and everybody gets drunk. And he goes, in this corner, a party starts out. And there's laughing and joking and stuff like that. In that corner, they're crying, and they're feeling sorry for themselves. Over here, fights are breaking out. People are getting punchy and stuff like that. And over there, everybody's having sex. And there's consequences with all of those. The party crowd gets the DUIs because they're chasing the party to party to party. The crying crowd, they don't get arrested or anything like that, but they do a lot of drunken dialing. The fight crowd, arrested for battery a lot. And in the sex crowd, unwanted babies or surprise babies, let's put it that way. But there's one thing we all have in common. Who wants seconds? And we're all here for more. Now, how that encompasses my drinking in a nutshell. When I first started drinking, I started in the party corner with the get to get into the sex corner. That's what I wanted to do. When I first heard that, I thought, well, I was never the crying type. Not true. My last 5 years, I was at home alone, feeling sorry for myself, drunk and dialing to the point where I finally got rid of all the numbers in my phone so I wouldn't like just call people and make plans and then say, where were you, and have no clue that I made the plan. My drinking at that point, the only consequence I had there was things would come from QVC, like what is this coming here for? Apparently I was watching a lot of TV and late night and ordering this stuff and calling them up and shipping my 50. I had a 600 square foot apartment in Chicago, and I was ordering like 50 piece cutlery sets and stuff like that. I don't cook. I just order out and use the microwave. It made no sense. Once women's makeup came, I guess I wanted to give it as a gift to somebody. I don't know. Here, you have real shitty makeup. Here's a gift for you. I don't know. All of it went back. Richard Rohr is a Jesuit priest who took a liking to AA, and he writes a lot about the steps. And I used to hear a lot of speakers share, and they were saying, oh, I'm a people pleaser, I'm a chameleon, I gave you whatever you want. And I would hear that and go, you know, that's not me. I'm not a people pleaser whatsoever. That's just one of the differences over there. But Richard Rohr said there's many elements of alcoholics in general. And there's the people pleaser, which is very common. And there's those who live under the illusion of control, that they are in control. When he hit that, it was right between the forehead. I was like, wow, that is me to a T back then, back growing up. Because the reason I fell in that way, if I was ever a people pleaser, it was beaten out of me at an early age. I stuttered when I was a child. I stuttered from the time I could talk until about 7 or 8 years old, where I just outgrew it. Because of that, I got beat on, spit on, thrown in a hole, kicked up, just massively picked on by boys. So I hung around girls. And all my friends were girls, or the fat kid, the weird kid, the nerds, you know. And they happen to be people pleasers. And if you are living under the illusion of control, if you surround yourself with a half a dozen people pleasers, can't be too many, you'd have to keep it small because you're controlling things, can't control the world, I understand that. You live under this illusion because you go, let's do this. Yeah, it's a good idea. Let's do this. Yeah, it's a good idea. And that's the way I went through life. And I didn't realize that until I broke through and came into the program. My whole story takes place in Chicago. I got sober in Chicago at age 45. So I rode this for a long time. Drugs are part of my story, but I'm going to sum it up this way. I started smoking marijuana when I was probably 16 years old, and it quickly fell into a get high every day, you know, and I did that till about age 30-something, and then I couldn't put like three sentences together without remembering what I was talking about, and I said, I'm done with this stuff, and I was done with it, just like that. Cocaine became big in the 80s. I was snorting it. I remember getting a gram and splitting it with like three buddies when I first did it, and you had a whole fun night on a little tiny gram. And by the end of 5 years, it was, give me the eight ball, I'm going home, I'm going to do it alone because I don't want to waste this stuff. So that progressed. And when I got to that point, I said, I'm done with this stuff. I don't want to do it anymore. And I knew I was done with it because this guy Joe, a friend from my college, and he came up to me at a party and goes, hey, you want to do a line? And I said, no, because and what I was thinking was, you do the line, give me your Coke, I'm going home and going to do it. And I said, no, and I was done with it. So I thought I knew drinking was becoming bigger and bigger proportions in my life, and I figured when it gets really bad enough, I'll just put it down like pot and Coke. Easy. Not easy at all for me. I'm going to take my coat off because I'm warm. Through growing up in Chicago, we were a poor family. Of course, I didn't know it. The entire block was in the same thing as us. So I never felt like I had needs or wants or anything like that. My dad had a little paint store, and he was building the business up. And I remember I used to go work with him on, you know, at the paint store on weekends, and painters would come by, and he'd play pinochle for money with painters and stuff like that. And I'd been to the corner bar just two stores down from him. And it was not unusual at age 10 or 11, he'd give me money to go get two six-packs of beer. They didn't sell 12-packs. Two six-packs of beer at the bar for my dad. And I'd go into the bar at 12 years old and say, my dad wants two six-packs of beer here. And I liked doing it because I got to keep the change. And I'd bring them back for the guys. So the reason I tell that story is alcohol was always around there. My dad was a heavy, heavy drinker. He did quit when he was 65 years old, and I told him he knew I was an AA, and he goes, I think I was an alcoholic for a while, too. He didn't know about alcoholism. But given a sufficient warning from a doctor at age 65, quit drinking, quit smoking, and he did. Now, he didn't just, like, put it away. When he passed away at age 82, I was helping my brother clean out his, he had an in-law apartment, my brother, and he had an unopened bottle of scotch and an unopened pack of cigarettes that were from when he gave it up at age 65, I guess just in case, break glass, you know, type of deal. So it was always in the back of his mind. But alcohol was in and around the family all the time. My mother was not a drinker. My mother was one of these people who would have a half a glass of wine and go, ooh, that's enough, I'm starting to feel it. Whatever. I felt as we were growing up, we were starting to move and take a long story and really encompass it. Due to three moves and quirks in school districts between third grade and high school, I switched. Basically, I was a new kid in school four times. That had a profound effect on me. I came in, and so I didn't. Again, I'm not a people pleaser, so I was like, you know, I could care less what you did. I was just under the radar. Never got in trouble. I did things wrong. I just put planned out ahead. They had senior cut day when I was a senior, and I just got the forms that give you a field trip, and it's the same form that if a grandparent died, I think my grandparents died like 17 times throughout high school, and I would say a grandparent died out of state, and I would just have my mom here as a field trip, and she'd sign it, and then I'd fill it all out, and then someone would die, and I'd turn it in, and then I'd have my day off. And but I didn't really spend it with anybody because I was kind of a loner. I really was. My first drink, my first opportunity to drink happened. I was a little bit late compared to most stories I hear in AA. I'm working with a guy now. I said, "When's your first drink?" He goes, 18. Jeez. But I was like 15, and I've had people go, "Jeez, that's a little late." And the first time it came, I was riding horses. I happened to be a natural at horseback riding, so I started to shovel poop at a barn and in order to take out trail rides for free. And so I was riding horses all the time. And it's a real mixture of people over there, a very odd mixture of people, some young to 30 years old, and alcohol is pretty easy to get. And we went on a moonlight ride, and someone brought a bottle of wine. And it was dark out in the trail, so it was just the stable hands out there. And the wine bottle came to me, and of course I wasn't going to go, "No thank you." But I pretended to take a pull off of it, because I was afraid of it. I was a very fearful kid. And the wine came to me, and I just kind of tongued it, you know, and passed it over, and that was the end of it. I didn't want to drink. I was frightened to drink. Move ahead a couple months at the barn. Now, this is wrong. I mean, I don't know the details here, so you can't ask me the details. But picture this, a Corvette convertible behind the barn in a suburb of Chicago, so it's not out in the woods, you know, behind the barn, a 30-year-old man with a toupee, me, 15 years old, with a 13-year-old girl on my lap, and he has the biggest bottle I've ever seen in my life, which I think is a Magnum of champagne. That's what my... for the longest time, I always remembered like those bottles they send off ships with, you know, but I think it's a little smaller than that bottle. But anyway, it's a big bottle. And do you want to have some? Yeah. And I drank it, and I drank it, and I drank it, and I felt it. And I felt it. And I don't know what happened after that. I remember going home on my bicycle. It's about a 15, 20-minute ride, about 8 miles through parking lots and everything like that. And the road was like on a ship. But I made it home, got upstairs, went to bed, got up the next morning to go to school, and I made it to the bus. I was really green, but I got through the whole day. And I can't say that after that time that, like, yes, this is the answer. I'm going to do this the rest of my life. But what it did tell me is, don't be afraid of it. There's really nothing to be afraid of. But there was no instant love affair for me, my story. I've heard a lot of people share otherwise. It wasn't until, roll ahead a couple months, and I went to my first overnight party at someone's sister's condo that had moved out, was on vacation, and someone's little sister took it over. And there was booze there, and it was there that I got lucky, all right, with a girl. And I associated alcohol with the guts to try to get the girl, and then I realized her defenses come down. That's when I put the connection together and go, this is the answer to life. I've got to figure this stuff out. And so I spent the next year trying to figure not to go past what I called the throw-up line. And I would drink enough and throw up. No one would see me throw. I was not one of these people like, help me, I'm sick. No, no, no. I'd go on there, boom, throw it up, and come back and try and figure it out the next time a little better. The bed would be rocking and things like that. I hated the spins and stuff, but I quickly got a tolerance for this stuff. Because I was tall, I'm 6'4". Now, 6'4", I'm like 250, 255 now. I was 6'4", 170. So, I mean, but we'd go out with the stable hands, and we'd go to the bowling alley bar, and we'd order bars. I'm 16, and we'd go to another place that was a supper club, a dinner club, that was really dark, and I would order drinks. My favorite drink at 16 years old was a vodka gimlet. It's the oddest drink for a 16-year-old to like, but I really liked those a lot. They worked fast, and they tasted good. I rode horses, and I stayed at that place for a good 10 years. I'd probably still be doing it, honestly, if I never got sober and they didn't tear the place down. But when they tore the place down, I had to do something, and I didn't know what to do, so I wound up going to college. And I went to a school 60 miles west of Chicago called Northern Illinois University, and I picked it, well, three places. I had help with a girl. I was too lazy to fill out the forms, and this girl, Laura, said, well, I took her to her prom. She asked me, she was 1 year younger than me. I said, yeah, sure, and I owe her an amend to this day, and I'll tell you why, because I took her to her prom, which is my high school's prom, but the junior class where I was a senior and I was a graduate and I was taking her there, and she was proud of it. All I remember is waking up in my car on her lap with the stereo on as loud as it can go and going, why'd you, she goes, I didn't want to bother you. She was so sweet like that. Anyway, this same girl that I destroyed her prom for, which I do owe her an amend, but I can't find her. Even on Facebook, I've been looking. And I said, and I really just would like to let her know that I acknowledge what I did was horrendous. And she helped me with my college entrance stuff. She literally filled it all out and said, here, sign it. And that's what I did. And three colleges picked me. I picked Northern Illinois because I was afraid to go away too far from home, right? As soon as I got there, I was like, I came back the next weekend. I got the rest of my stuff. My parents didn't see me again for 3.5 years. I was gone. I was at home in college. Everybody drank just like me. I got involved in a fraternity. They're, I think in the big book, Dr. Bob or called them drinking fraternities. That's what it was. I became the rush chairman at this drinking fraternity. And they were new to the campus. We had our brand new house, and I rushed an entire class just like me. No one knew who we were, so I kept my parties going to 5 a.m. All the other fraternities shut it down at 11. It still wasn't, and so people would go, hey, they're still partying over there, free beer, let's go over there. And then in the middle of rush week, I decided, I'm an outside-the-box thinker. I always have been a little bit along those lines. I was thinking outside the box, and I said, my friend plays a band. I'll get his band over here. We're going to throw an open party. We're going to sell beers for a quarter or whatever it was. We get the beer trucks in there and go through 40 kegs in a night with the band playing over there. And while rush was going on, so everybody's people were at our house. We made the big time. There was an emergency meeting of the Panhell Council, and they came up with a rule, no more open parties during rush. Could have named that one after me. I was quite proud of that. Anyway, so I went ahead and I graduated. And then reality slipped me. I was not in a big hurry to graduate. I said 3.5 years. I had 2 years under my belt before I came into this at a junior college. So I was in no hurry to graduate. But eventually the time does come. And I went home and got a crappy job, no experience type job, and living in my parents' basement, not a good place to be. While I was doing that, a buddy of mine was working at the Playboy Club in Chicago, and he called me up, and I got a job actually at a grocery store right out of college. That's what you do out of college, right? Bagging groceries, but it's a job. And he would call me up and say, let's. I got some bunnies. We're gonna meet them down at the bar at one. He was a busboy at the Playboy Club, and we go out to 5-6 a.m. and I turn around and go back in the morning, and I would be at work at 7 a.m. or 7:30 or 8, whatever time I had to start. And I did that, and I worked until about 3, and then I went home and ate and crashed and did it all over again the next night. And to supplement my income over here, I had a lucrative marijuana selling business, and a lot of the butchers, and I was pretty much a wholesaler moving pounds. I'd find the guy that had the 5 pounds, and I would get pounds, and I would say, here, I'm taking this for myself, you have the rest, and I'd make money. I think at this point I was actually making more money than my father, and I'm living in his parents' basement with no rent whatsoever. My mom's doing my laundry, totally spoiled kid. I eventually got a real job and moved into that, and then I decided to get married. And this girl, I can't say I loved her, but she didn't mind me partying, and she told me she was allergic to alcohol. I didn't understand what that meant. Her sister was an alcoholic. Her twin sister was an alcoholic. But none of this was... And I did see her drunk one time, and I said, you're not a very nice drunk. Don't do that anymore. So she just smoked marijuana and was quite happy with that on a pot-smoking basis. And we had 3 okay years of marriage, 2 so-so, and 4 years of pure hell. That describes those 9 years of with it. There was no true love. I didn't know how to love anybody. I was incapable of really doing that. And so it all just culminated to a head where she, after that 5-year point in 93, everything happened. The work had quality problems. I was always able to maintain the work thing going. So, and I was in outside sales, so I was able to hide my drinking very, very well. And while work was going bad, people were getting laid off, and I was getting new territories, and I was doing less and drinking more and getting awards for how well I was doing. And in my mind, I was doing really, really well. But my drinking started taking serious proportions at this point, because I was always a binge drinker on Friday and Saturday, and all of a sudden now it's like Thursday night, Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And then she started drinking when I said, hey, we have some quality problems at work, cut back on money. She heard, we're broke. Typical alcoholic response, we're broke. And she started drinking like I've never seen anybody drink in my life, even me in my drinking, hiding it and mean and just her. She just got out of a detox. She was in detox 5 times, just got out of detox. I come home on a Monday after she got out on Sunday or Monday morning, and she was drunk when I came home from work. And I came, I said, what are you doing? And she had a bottle of vodka in her hand. I took the bottle out of her hand. She dials 911. It's winter time. The cops come. We live next door to the police station. And they called me back when she hung up. And I said, well, you come over, that's fine, but leave the lights off. I don't want the neighbors looking. I mean, I'm totally stone cold sober. And she's just bombed out of her mind. And I learned how the laws, at least at that time, are really stacked against the guys. He came over to the house. She came running out of the car in the snow, and he goes, in her socks, and he goes, get back in the house. And we had one little stoop to come into our ranch house, and she tripped, and I tried to catch her, and I didn't get her in time. She chipped her tooth, smashed her face up, was a bloody mess. And he's sitting over there, he goes, all right, well, they have like detectives for family disturbances or whatever, and they're going to come over here. So he leaves, and then 30 seconds later, these detectives come in, and they're like, got me against the wall, go, what'd you do to her? Let me look at your hands. Let me look at your hands. I said, I didn't do anything. I tried to catch her. I couldn't get there in time. And they said, I remember the guy had a Snidely whiplash, the first cop bus. I go, call the guy with the mustache. He knows. And they called him up, and he verified it. So they said, I don't know what happened with that. Nothing happened. And I said, the only one that's been getting hit here is me. And they looked at me and said, you're big enough, you can take it. Because she's a tiny little girl. And so I was like, okay, fine. So a few more times in the rehab, and I finally had enough. And during this process, I read a book for her. It's called Drinking a Love Story by Carolyn Knapp. It wound up being my introduction to AA. And it's basically her AA story, nothing more. But in the middle of that book are like the 12 questions or whatever. And I was answering them for my wife in real bold and then putting little dots underneath for me. And I was lying and I was still hitting like 8 of them. I lied and cheated all the time. That was me. I'm a liar and a cheat. That's my nature. I'm a liar and a cheat. I'm also, for the longest time, I used to say I was never a fighter. Yeah, I didn't have to fight because people just kind of avoided me, which is good. But I was a right fighter for the longest time. I wanted to be right, and you damn it better agree with me, and you too, and you too. And if you don't, I'm going to sit here and act like the biggest baby until you finally give up and go, yes! And you don't make friends that way. You really don't. But and I can still fall in that trap of, you know, if I'm feeling threatened, yeah, I fight, but it's verbal fight. I could bash somebody verbally. It's horrendous. A step six character defect I work on all the time, and I'm much better at it than I was before. I finally said we want a divorce. We sold the house, and I moved into one of these communities that have the bar. It's a singles community with a bar right on the property, and I thought, fantastic, I'll just go to the bar every day. I learned I'm not a bar drinker, not at all. I'm a vodka out of the bottle drinker, and you do that at home. And I didn't want to become an alcoholic, though I was clearly drinking like an alcoholic. So I only drank after I worked out. You should have seen the shape I was in that summer. I worked out and got a bottle of vodka and drank myself to oblivion, and that's what I was doing. And it wasn't until a little bit later that I started drinking in the morning. And I remember the first time I took a drink, I was just crushing hangover. I got hair of this hair to dog stuff. I'll give it a try. I was like, I should have been doing this years ago. This is really good. Well, you don't remove your hangover. You just delay it and you pay it with interest later. That's really what actually happens. And the danger, and I fell into this danger, is you eventually get in a situation where now you don't take a sober breath day or night and you start sleeping. And I hated waking up at wintertime around 6. And I have to turn on the TV to see what kind of programming was on, to know if it was AM or PM. Bad situation. And I was this, and so I moved, I got a DUI when I was still married, but that I didn't think was really a problem, but it did teach me one thing when I went through this DUI. I called the soon-to-be ex-wife. She picked me up at 4:30 I got it. At 7:30 she picked me up at the police station. I didn't even spend it in a proper jail. It was a dog kennel. It was a suburban Illinois state police department in like a industrial mall, and they had a dog cage there. It didn't even have a lock on it. It just had one of those little U things. And there was a guy standing on the other side. And so I'm sitting in the chair in the dog kennel. And then he goes, all right, here's the paperwork. And I was nice and polite, like I always am to cops. And she picked me up and just giving me an earful. Even though she goes to, she's been to rehab, or not rehab, but to dry out, spin dry for over and over and over again. I'm getting it. And we go by the place that towed my company car. And I was like, hey, they're still open. Go in there. So she pulled in. They go, they got my car. It's $100 because it was only in there for like an hour or two or three or whatever. And so I paid the $100 and she let her go. And I had a bottle of Seagram 7 under my seat. And I'm coming down really hard and I've got some bad news coming at it. And that's when I really knew that I was powerless, because I was still drunk from the night before, and I took sips off of that thing just to get home. I moved to this complex, drank the whole time. I didn't want to get another DUI, so I thought I better move into the city, so I moved into Wrigleyville. And it was next to my drinking buddy, so I could walk everywhere. And they had bars around there, and the few times I try and recapture my days of chasing ladies, it would be, I would go from bar to bar to bar, and I knew if I could catch someone's eye in the first 10 minutes of walking in the place, I was going to get lucky. If I didn't, I would have one and go to the next bar, and believe it or not, that worked. That, as simple as that was, that worked. And that was the extent of the relationships I would have, one night, and that's it, because I don't know how to love. It all came crashing down when I looked into the mirror one day, and this is the end, the beginning of the end for me. I was going on these 5 days of not being sober at all, week being just drunk. I don't know how I maintained the job, except I was always able to put 5 minutes of speech together. So I did the bare minimum: phone calls, hang up, be drunk the whole time, never get out of my underwear, except to go to the store to get more liquor and take the dog for a walk. And I looked at myself. I said, "You're a waste of skin. I hate everything about you. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you." And I wanted to die. I just wanted to die. But I wasn't going to take it the quick way. I knew I was drinking myself to death. And the very last bottle I ever bought, I was getting these pains, these horrendous pains, and then it would go away after a day. And I think it was gastritis or whatever the case may be. But there was really some gut work that was not going very good with me. And the last drink that I had, there was 6'4". I come into the Pakistani liquor store, and there was a small black gentleman in front of me. Looked not well to do. He's not riding the gravy train by any stretch of the imagination. And he goes and he's getting a bottle of like Skol vodka, like the little pint of it. And I had my Absolut, and I had this window of opportunity, this dawning on, hey, you're the same. There's zero difference between you. Zero. He's a little further down the road, but there's no difference between you. And as I walked out of the liquor store, I used to bring my dog there. I'm walking out of the liquor store, and a bus came by with the Hazleton billboard on the side of the bus. Now, I don't know what Hazleton was, but I figured it out after. It was like a subliminal thing, you know? And then I saw and it must have been there for years, but on the poles, "Do you have a drug and drinking problem? Call this number." And I saw that, and I was like, wow, this is, I mean, I just noticed all these things. Now, did that prevent me from drinking? Not at all. I went on a bender for the next 5 days, where on September 5th, I finally gave it, September 5th, 2002, which was my sobriety day, where I finally gave it up. And it was after piercing pain on all day Thursday, and part of Wednesday, and all day Thursday. And I decided Thursday to call AA. So I got the phone number and waited till Friday morning. I didn't want to call him too late on Thursday. I didn't know they manned the phones all the time. And I called at 10, and the guy goes, "Hey, have you tried quitting drinking?" And I said, "Yeah, and I've not been successful." He goes, "Well, we've got an answer for you. Here's three meetings." And I picked one. It was in Lincoln Park. It was a little further away from my house, but it was a nice little bike ride. It's in September. It's nice out. And I drove there, and it was a place called Three Crosses in Chicago. Very, very old sobriety there. You know, in all the meetings that I've ever been to since, they always ask, "Is this someone's very first time ever in AA?" I learned that what happened that night, someone forgot the paperwork, so they're just like winging it. And they never asked that question. And I got there, and it was a room very similar to this, a little better ambience, but very the way it's set up. And I sat in the middle of the room. I got there on time, like I always get on time. Time is not one of my problems. And I sat in the middle of the room, and a woman told her story. Her name was Kai. I remember that. Very, very attractive woman, which got my interest right away. And she was married. Doesn't matter to me. I mean, I'm a newcomer. It's okay. And she told me I was really good looking at the break, and I go, I really like her a lot now. But it's feeding the sharks at this point, for as far as I'm concerned. But she said something in her story that floored me, because many of us have done this. She talked about how well she hid her drinking from everybody. It was really important to look good on the outside. I'm working out and drinking, all right? You want to look really good. I had money enough to buy clothes and look decent as far as that goes, and so that was all important to me. And she said she would rotate liquor stores so no one could figure out the amount she drank, and she would never use the recycled bin. You bury that in the dirtiest garbage you could find. Me too. I remember that. I don't remember much else after that, but I do remember she told her story at the break. Everybody went out, and I was still smoking cigarettes at the time. I was having a cigarette, and a guy came up to me and goes, "So what meetings do you go to?" I said, "I just came in off the street." And then they made this huge deal about the newcomer in their midst. And I was like, yeah. And I remember one woman, an older woman, everybody had 20, 30 years. So everybody was an old woman. I'm an old man now, but everybody was an old person over there. But this guy was more my age, 45 years old, 40, 45 years old. And He gave me the little AA book, and this woman came up. She goes, "Remember, you could always drink tomorrow." And I started laughing. She goes, "Why is that so funny?" I said, "My ex-wife used to promise sex to me that way all the time." She goes, "Did you ever have it?" I said, "Never." She goes, "See, it really works." And then so I asked this guy to be my sponsor. He had 18 years. I thought, great. And he showed me where all the meetings were. But he was one of these guys, go to meetings. You'll get sober. Go to meetings. You get sober. And he gave me the meeting book. And I opened it up when I got home. And I bought the big book because they said buy a big book. The first 164 pages, I read it that night. All 164 pages, I just skimmed right through it. Didn't retain zero, absolutely zero. It got to we agnostics, I believe in God. To the wives, don't have one anymore. That's how I read the book. But there was a meeting behind my house at 9 a.m. Now, I had an experience at this first meeting that I went to at 9 o'clock when they all circled up and did the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. I had this chill that went down my back. It was like a tingly feeling. And I felt it once before, and it happened about a year and a half earlier where I was having a real hard time, real, real hard time. And I got in bed and I said, "God," and I always believed in something, "God, please help me. And I got that same peace, and I was able to sleep, and I didn't drink for like 2 days. I felt it again. So I look at back now on there, that's kind of like God talking to me. So I go to this next meeting at 9 a.m. I'm all excited for AA because this is like the greatest experience in the world. I had this the night before. This is wonderful. And I'm not thinking of drinking. It's really weird. For me, the first time I went to a meeting, that was gone. Not to say I didn't think about it from time to time, but that obsession, for some reason, was lifted. That's, again, God working in my life because I have no explanation for it. And I go to this meeting, and everybody's there with a blank face at 9 a.m., and I found out they're all there because of court orders or treatment center type stuff, and it was a forced meeting. And I remember 15 minutes into this thing, and I was like, this is horrible. And I don't know what I shared, but I know I had to share something because I have all this experience from the night before, and you people don't see this. But I've been jacked up on AA ever since that time. So here I come in, I'm extremely willing, and I have a sponsor who's telling me go to meetings and call me every day. I call him about this crappy meeting, and he goes, "Go to different meetings. Try them on like you try a suit coat on off the rack. Eventually you find one that fits you." And I was like, okay. So I tried all these different. They said do 90 and 90. I probably did 290 on weekends. I would just go all day. And then I was hearing this common theme. And then I got a sponsor, and we did the work through the book, and the steps changed my life. Call my sponsor up. "Hey, I'm hearing these people talking about doing the steps through the book, and their lives are changing. I want that. Go to meetings. Don't worry about it." So I quit calling them, and I didn't have a sponsor then. And 40 days into sobriety, I had bought a trip a year earlier to Africa. And I told everybody I'm going to Africa, and they go, "You're really new. You should not. It's not a sober trip." "No, it's normal people. Stay home." I said, "Well, it cost me $2,000. I know you pass a basket around here. Perhaps you can do a little drive for me, and if you pay me $2,000, I'll be happy to stay." That didn't come, so I went. They said, "Well, read your big book." Okay, I brought my big book, sponsorless, riding a pink cloud. And I met my wife, Susie, what would be my wife, a very, very, very wet drunk. At the end of her drinking, in fact, 9 months later, she would get sober. So that's where she's at in her drinking. It's coming to an end. And didn't seem that, her behavior certainly didn't seem outrageous to me because I had lived it not too long ago. And I saw her in the morning. She goes, and she took an instant liking to me. She goes, "Would you like to go to the Crown Room?" "Absolutely. I don't know what the Crown Room is, but let's go." I wasn't a world traveler at the time. And so we went to the Delta Crown Room. She ordered a Bloody Mary, and that doesn't seem unusual to me. I had a Virgin Mary, all right? And we just drank and talked and stuff like that. On the plane from Atlanta to Johannesburg, It was dark. I'm reading my big book. The whole plane was dark. I'm in a bulkhead seat. There's a woman next to me with a baby in her arms. And I have the little light on. And Susie was sitting like the other section over staring at me. And I saw that. And I'm going like, man, she's kind of cute. And I think she likes me. I don't know. And then she came over to me with like the liquor cart behind her. And so and sat on my lap and goes, here, have a Bailey's. And I go, No, thank you. But I liked all the lap dance I'm getting. I really am, I'm enjoying this a lot. And I wasn't a traveler at the time. On long international flights, you don't wear baggy shorts because it's cold on an airplane. But I had shorts on because it was hot when we left. And I remember she asked me specifically, take your hand off my derriere, and she was cupping my junk under my pants, and she calls it her pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. She's telling her story in 2 weeks, so you get to hear the other side of that. And so I didn't know what to make of all this, and all this little party started out around this. The woman next to me is getting annoyed, and all this is going on, and finally it just kind of like all this fizzles away and breaks up, and I looked to her. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry for all that. She looked at me and said, it's not your fault. Whoa, that was news to me. And this whole time when Susie's giving me the lap dance and I'm reading the big book, you know what my thoughts are to that? These must be the promises they're talking about. They have to be. I mean, I equated sex with alcohol, and here I'm equating sobriety with sex, and this is really good because I didn't know how I was going to do it sober because I had never done it sober in my life. Even when I was married for the 9 years, I was drunk every single time we had sex, all my life. So this was really charting new waters for me, and I found out it works. And then so I came to the conclusion, alcohol still needs to play a big part, but only for one of us. The other one doesn't have to do it. Well, I got back home to Chicago. I didn't drink. I told her about my alcoholism, and when I told her that, and she tells her story, sometimes she says, yes, but now I don't drink. Oh, I don't know how we're going to make it, but it intrigued her. It's probably why we're still together. And she's wound up being the first person I actually 12-stepped into the room, long distance. I didn't call her at night because she'd slur her words too badly. And I met George, my sponsor, and when I heard him say those magic words at this Monday night meeting, it was a step a week. They wrote at 12 a week before, now it's on step one. And George said he's celebrating his 10-year birthday that day. And the first 8 years, he did the Sinatra program, My Way. And he goes, his life was small and he was just feeling like crap. And then he finally got a sponsor who did the work through the book, and his life changed, and it's gotten big and exciting and fun. So afterwards, I said, George, would you be my sponsor? And he goes, yeah, I'd love to. Read the doctor's opinion. You have a book? Yes. Did you read it? Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, I did. He goes, well, read the doctor's opinion. I said, I don't recall that one. He goes, it's before page one. Okay. And so I did, and I called him the next morning. I read it all. Good. Now read it again. This time, underline where you see yourself. So I did that, and I called him. And the whole time, I'm wondering, what the hell are we going to start these steps? I want to do the steps. All right. And he goes, all right, we're going to meet. Great. So we met at some restaurant, and he sits down and he starts in the beginning of the book saying, this is what you know about sobriety, absolutely nothing, and this is the first promise how many have recovered from alcoholism, and he went through the table of contents, and then he read the doctor's opinion to me, and it was so much different than me skipping the book than it was when I first got in there, is read and reflect, and I associated with what that doctor was saying. I really associated with it. And then little did I know that we were already taking the steps. We're on our road to that. Did the same thing with Bill's story and more about alcoholism. And then he had me write a list. This is really amazing. I was going to do everything. I'm willing. And he goes, write a list of how your life is unmanageable, not just when you're drinking, but like all the time. And I was like, so I did. I remember two of the things were on there, bleeding gums and bleeding butthole. Those were two of the things that were definitely on at the end of my drinking. He never asked me to read it to him. And I was really like, baffled by that. And then we're going, and he goes, right, give me a little description. I'm asking you to pray. And at this time it was, help me in the morning, thank you at night, good enough. Do it on your knees. Put your shoes on the ground, on the floor. Go on to bed and get them. Go on your knees, ask for help. And so I was doing it. I did what I was told. And I didn't understand it, but okay. And we're going to step two. Describe your God. So I make like the perfect parent is my higher power. And it was really weird because the best I could do there was it was that guy that was out in the beyond the clouds and the whatever's there. And that was my God. Looked like Monty Python's guy, an old man in the clouds. That's what I pictured. And it wasn't until we started going into the book that all of a sudden he said, you look here within God. So all of a sudden my concept changed. He was okay with that list, by the way. He just wanted to make sure my name wasn't on it. That's all he cared about. And it shifted from out there to in here. And then once God was in here, I realized when God is blocked in me, I block God off from, and then you notice it by how you act at me. I don't hold resentments these days. I really don't. After 14 years of sobriety, but I will tell you, I'm really good at giving other people resentments. And I make amends for them, but they hold these resentments. But it's, you know, and I try not to do that less and less and less, but I happen to have a knack for it. So we did step two, we did step three. At step four, we did step three at his house. Got on our knees and said the prayer together, and he sent me to step four to go and write. And I did, or I did the best I could, and then I lost it, and I had to write it again. And I said, because I lost it, I'm assuming someone might have read it, so therefore I don't have to do a fifth. He said, no, it doesn't work that way. I said, okay, you wouldn't let me like squirm out of it. It wasn't anything all that earth-shattering on it. It took me a good two solid hours to actually do the columns, and you know, the Joe and Charlie columns is what I found actually online that I did, and I give my guys that now. And during this 2 months, I had a near miss. I was going to meetings every day, and there was a meeting, a 12 and 12 meeting. I was a Wednesday in a basement of a church, and I was selling my condo. And man, this was really close because I hadn't done the fifth step yet. I'm only writing my fourth, and I'm kind of like lazy on it. And my phone rings. It's the realtor. So I go out to the hall politely, and I'm talking. My voice carries, if you haven't noticed. And they close the door. I finish my call. The fuckers locked me out of the room. Those sons of bitches locked me out of the room. Sorry to swear from it, but this is what I was thinking. And I'm going to show you I'm getting drunk. I was pissed off. And I left that church and with the determination to get drunk. And while I was walking to the liquor store, I decided to give George an earful, too. So I called him up. I said, George, you know, these bastards locked me out of that room. He goes, did you knock on the door? I said, no. He goes, do you think it's possible that someone just closed the door and didn't know it was locked? I guess that's why you're a sponsor. Okay? So that would diffuse the whole thing. But that rage that I had gotten into, and he goes, write your four steps. So I did it. And we did a fifth step. And I learned the patterns that set me off. I learned how I was such a right fighter. And that every time I got that way, I hurt myself to get back at you. That's my character defect. I'm going to hurt me. And you're gonna feel that pain because they're going to make you feel real sorry for me. One speaker, St. Jeff, shared it with me. It's like resentment's like setting yourself on fire and hoping the other guy dies of asphyxiation. And that was the rage that I went through. Six and seven, I did it literally originally from the book. I went home, put a book on the shelf, and waited an hour. Took it down, did step seven prayer, called George. Hey, I did the prayer. I didn't miss anything. Okay, great. Now we're going to do the amends, and I did the amends. And the amends process, there's like the girl Laura that destroyed her prom. There's still amends I have to make. I just can't get to these people. But I have found through the use of Facebook is a curse sometimes, especially if it's like amends that 20 years ago you wouldn't have to make, because there's no way you're going to see these people, and all of a sudden they show up on Facebook, and you're like, yike. And so there's one guy I picked on horrendously in college. He was in my fraternity. I had to write him an amend. I offered to speak with him. I would have saw him, but he was just writing only on Facebook message. And then the other thing too, and this is amazing, at home, my home life with my wife, Susie, started to deteriorate. And I was calling my sponsor about it and praying about it. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And she's turning into every woman I've ever been with in my life. And I figured there's only one common denominator, and that's me. And I'm sober now. This is, you know, I'm 13 years at the time, and I'm sober. And this is just disintegrating before my eyes. And then Facebook, the last true love of my life, which is the woman before the one that I got married to, showed up on Facebook. And I read a book, a detective novel, and there was one line in there that stuck out on me. The human mind is not made to forget. It's made to put away, ignore. It takes thoughts and ignores. And then this, it was like a sheet coming off a picture, and I saw the whole picture as soon as I saw her. I saw how selfish and self-centered I was, and how obstinate and such a right fighter that I was. And then I'm doing it to Susie. And I don't need to make an amend to this woman, but I'm doing that. God showed me the way just like that. Boom. I have God working in my life a lot of ways. And this is the only thing I wrote down tonight. I'm going to finish with this because I think we're good for that. God talked to me in several ways. Right after I got sober, the very first snowfall in Chicago is very, very nice. It makes the city white and clean. And it's really quiet. It's just wonderful. And I was taking a train to a meeting, and I got off one exit early so I could walk in the city while the snow was falling. And there I had this bright idea. I'll get drunk on opening day, Wrigley Field. It'll only be like 6 months. I've seen people come and go like this. It's not going to be a big deal. Just opening day, that's the only day I'm going to get drunk. And I sat down in the meeting, and this guy was, it was as a Bill Sees It meeting, and he shared for 15 minutes. He said he's picking up a five-year chip for the second time. Okay? He was on vacation in Mexico, and he wound up drinking like he was with his friends all week long, and the last day of this whole thing he wound up taking a drink, and it nearly killed him 3 years later when he couldn't stop. He just couldn't get it a second time. He was given a gift the first time and he couldn't get it again. And I thought, okay, that's a bad idea. That's God working in my life. I told you about the chills I had when I drank in the first meeting. That's God talking to me. I had 4 years into my sobriety, I learned I have diverticulum, and I ruptured an artery, and I nearly bled to death. And I had a sponsee and my wife. That was the only, you know, and I had a home group. People saw me and stuff like that. I nearly died twice. They put in 14 or 15 bags of blood in me, so that's like I'm bleeding out, no surgery or anything like that. But as I was dying, my thought was not about me, about fear or anything like that. All I said was, Susie, whatever you do, tell Tom and you don't drink over this. No matter what happens, don't drink over this. Those are not words that normally would come out of my mouth in those situations, I don't think. There was a guy that in Vining, Ricky, came in drunk off his mind out into the rooms. And he was with a small, little, well-dressed man. And he brings them into the room, and I'm sharing, and you know, first tradition says it's the group comes first. You're not going to let the drunk share, and so I was sharing, and he's tapping me on. I got something to say, and I was like, look, you're in the right place. Should sit down, shut up. We'll talk to you after the meeting. And he just hated that. He wanted to go into treatment shortly thereafter. But the guy that brought him in, I said, what meetings do you go to? He goes, well, I don't go to any meetings. This is my very first AA meeting. I just saw this poor guy wandering around the parking lot and decided to give him a help. He said he wanted to go to a meeting, so I drove him here. I was like, that was like God coming down in the body of this man. I had an episode of a customer that I was working really hard for, but I did a poor job of communicating what I was doing for this customer, trying to help her get on an airplane that she missed. And she blasted me a new butthole. I mean, it was just nasty. And all of a sudden, all my isms came back to me. You're worthless. You're bad. You're a piece of crap. You're not worth the skin that you're in. And I was just feeling all the self on me. I was crushed with self. It was a Thursday night. I drove to the Fifth Tradition for their big book study. I didn't say hello to a soul. And I sat in the back corner of the room. And when they, at the end of the meeting, you stand up for sponsorship. I didn't stand up because I'm not worthy to sponsor anybody. And I was laughing because, you know, I carry the message to the DeKalb prison as part of the, you know, service thing that we do. At the, and you raise your hand, and we always laugh. No one ever comes up to go, tell me about jail. You know, for 3 years we're doing this, you know. So who does the jail? I do one of these things. I'm getting up to go and a tap on the shoulder. Here's a guy with busted glasses, missing tooth, clearly a newcomer. Tell me about the jail thing. Why? He goes, I just felt compelled to ask you. And he turned out he was a believer in God. And I was like, you know, and I talked about him. And I walked out of there on a cloud. Here I ask God for help, and God gives me a newcomer to tap me on the shoulder, ask me about something no one ever asked then or since about. His name was David. I saw him get a tooth. I saw him fix his glasses. I saw him over the next coming months while he was living in the halfway house. And he got sober. That's how God talks to me. Now, these could be just coincidence. If you're a non-believer, that's fine. But eventually you start seeing a whole line of coincidences, and it's like breadcrumbs. You go, maybe there's something to this, and I'm convinced of it. I carry the message all the time. It's absolutely a pleasure to teach this program. I have a sponsee now. He goes, what do I do now? I said, you got to carry the message. Can we do the steps again? I go, no, just carry the message. You'll do them again and again and again. And every time you do, you get a little bit more knowledge. And that's all I have. Thank you.